Now, this is the first opportunity I've had to respond to comments made about me personally from this pulpit three Sunday evenings ago. It was at the very start of this series that we're continuing tonight on Joseph. And if you were here, you may remember that at the beginning of his sermon, Hugh Palmer drew attention to the fact that I was featured in a recent edition of the magazine Cosmopolitan. Now, to be totally accurate, it was Cosmopolitan Bride magazine. So I just mentioned that just in case you rushed out to buy a copy and you couldn't actually find me in it. Anyway, I have to tell you that I'm still very puzzled, even now after all this time, I'm very puzzled about Hugh's motive in bringing this to your notice. Was he aiming to smear my character or to enhance my reputation? Now, perhaps it's better I don't know the answer. And to be perfectly honest, it isn't terribly important. And much more important was Joseph's reputation. And that's where we're going to start as we look together at the next installment of this story, beginning with chapter 42. So if you're trying to get a plan of the sermon, we're going to start with heading number one. That's life, the road to Egypt. That's life, the road to Egypt. Now, the Joseph story so far is his reputation seesawing first one way and then the other. Violent swings in favor and out of favor. As a boy, he was favored by his father Jacob, so much so that he was then very cruelly disposed of by his brothers, sold into slavery. And we look through the various passages in Genesis relating to Joseph, and we see there were many ups and downs. And then suddenly one day, Pharaoh was making him number two in his kingdom, with massive responsibilities. As Egypt stocked up in preparation for 5 years of famine, and perhaps we look at our own lives and we think, well, life is like that sometimes. Our fortunes can change, sometimes quite quickly. Like John Terry of Chelsea in last week's football final in Moscow. One moment he's saving a goal brilliantly, and a little later on he's missing a goal, which inevitably, I think, left his team staring at defeat. But that event was nothing as extreme as the swings in the reputation of Joseph. And today we pick up the story with Joseph once as good as dead, once a long-term prisoner for a crime that he never actually committed, now in charge, it says, of the whole land of Egypt. Now, we cannot this evening read our way through the whole of chapters 42 to 45. It would take too long. But recently we have been following the impact of huge natural disasters in Myanmar, and that's Burma and China. The famine of Joseph's time, affecting the whole region, not just Egypt itself, made an impact of a very surprising kind. So let me fast track you through these chapters. It won't take very long, but you will need to know roughly what the story is all about. So let's look together at chapter 42, verses 1 and 2. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, given that there was a famine back in Canaan where they lived, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" And he commented, "I have heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." Now, as we read on, we find that two verses provide the key for the drama that was to unfold. Like verse 4, "But Jacob did not send Benjamin." Verse 4 reads, "But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others, because he was afraid that harm might come to him." And then we're going to verse 7, although we'll start with verse 6. Verse 6 reads, "Now Joseph was the governor of the land of Egypt, the one who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground." Of all people in Egypt, they just happened, it felt at the time, that they met the brother they had once sold to the slave traders. in their minds, probably now dead. And just as in Joseph's dream, all those 20 years ago, they bowed down to him, not recognizing him at all. But, and this is crucial, that's why we need to look at verse 7, as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. But he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. Anyway, eventually they headed back home to their father in Canaan again, with what they had purchased from the grain mountains of Egypt. Joseph had talked with them, asked all sorts of questions about their father and their youngest brother, whom he had never met. But the brothers had left minus Simeon, who was left hostage to ensure that next time they brought Benjamin with them as well. And so it was a family reunion that was never a family reunion, if you know what I mean. And then we turn on to chapter 43, if you turn over the page, and the first half of chapter 44. And we have the same thing all over again, right at the beginning of the chapter. Let me read it. Now the famine was still severe in the land. Verse 1. So when they had eaten all the grain they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, "Go back and buy us a little more food." Jacob called Israel sometimes. Jacob wanted Benjamin to stay behind again. But one of the brothers, Judah, insisted that they had no option but to take him, and off they went. As we see verse 3, but Judah said to his father, and it's the buts in the story that changed the course of events. As it says in verse 3, but Judah said to him, "The man," that means Joseph, "warned us solemnly, you will not see my face again unless your brother is with you." Now all went quite smoothly until, engineered by Joseph, there became a major hiccup in the whole proceedings, because Joseph was still pretending he didn't know them, although he was in fact treating them very well. But he allowed them, apparently, to go home again with all that they needed. However, a silver cup had been planted in Benjamin's luggage. Joseph's servants were told to ride after them. They found the cup, surprise, surprise, and escorted all the brothers back to Joseph. And those brothers, of course, being very distraught and frightened. And Judah is very much the spokesman, even though he wasn't actually the eldest of the brothers. Let's just read what it says in chapter 44, verses 16 and 17. This was when they were faced again with Joseph. "What can we say to my lord?" Judah replied. "What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We're now my lord's slaves, we ourselves, and the one who was found to have the cup." But Joseph said, "Far be it from me to do such a thing. Only the man who was found to have the cup will become my slave." That was Benjamin. "The rest of you, go back to your father in peace." Now this was the brothers' worst of all nightmares. They didn't go home and tell Jacob, because they knew that it would kill him. And then follow two very remarkable features. When you get a bit of time, have a look at them quite carefully. One is from Judah, which is the rest of chapter 44, which when you read it, you'll see is very moving, reasoned, wise, unselfish, passionate. And it ends in verse 33, so I'll read that. "Now then, please let your servant," he said to Joseph, "please, let your servant," that's me, "remain here as my lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father." And then the other speech from the start of chapter 45 comes from Joseph. And this time he breaks down in tears. The mask comes off. And Joseph says in verse 3, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. And then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." What a life. But also, as we're beginning to realize as we look through this extraordinary story, what a family. And so it is that we come to heading number two. That's families, the road to reconciliation. That's families, the road to reconciliation. We can only imagine the pressure on Joseph with a job like his. First, stockpiling food in the good years, and then managing its distribution over 5 years of bitter famine. That needs an overall manager of the very highest caliber, skilled, wise, discerning, honest, and tough. And Pharaoh considered Joseph was the only man for the job, and he was right. It is one thing to have power, even a little, and another thing to handle it. And Joseph was able to handle it well. And yet later his message to his father is, "God has made me. God has made me Lord of all Egypt." Now for those of us working in a very secular or non-Christian environment like Joseph, that's quite a statement. It puts our own abilities into perspective, and it also reminds us who really puts us there. Anyway, as if all that responsibility wasn't enough for one pair of shoulders, his family arrive on the doorstep. Just imagine. And in a flash, his past, Joseph's past, catches up with him. The very 10 brothers who all those years ago decided to get rid of him forever. That had been no accident. It was calculated, conniving, brutal torture, only 1 degree short of murder. When Joseph's first son had been born, he called him Manasseh, born in Egypt, named because it meant, "It is because God has made me forget all my troubles and all my father's household." But as we have made discovered for ourselves and our own family lives, family issues are never completely buried. Now, no two family situations are the same, but very rarely are families completely straightforward. Having taken many funerals, a time when the family history is so often exposed, I know it is usual for families to contain some surprises, painful surprises sometimes, not far under the surface. Perhaps yours is one of those. Joseph's family is weirder than most. Was there any way that this very desperate family could achieve a genuine reconciliation? And as we read through the story, we find incredibly the answer is yes. So without promising it can work for anyone else, it is worth a look at the various elements, the ingredients that marked this road to family reconciliation. And if you all happen to be jotting them down, here they are. There are 6 ingredients. I'll go through them one by one, but they're crisis, nerves, guilt, emotions, trust, and generosity. Crisis. It's so often a crisis that brings things to a head. It may be an illness or bereavement or divorce. It may be the will or unemployment and so on. A couple of weeks ago, Justine Henin, the Belgian tennis player, the world number 1, retired from the game. And an article about her revealed that 6 members of her family, including her mother, her sister, and baby nephew, had all died in exceptionally sad circumstances. She had no contact with her father for 10 years, and neither he nor Justine's brothers or surviving grandparents were invited to a wedding in 2002, sadly a marriage that has since ended in divorce. But the article continued like this: "The reconciliation process started when David, a brother who fell into a coma after being injured in a car accident, awoke to find Justine at his bedside. Several members of her family then flew to Paris when Justine won the French Open. And she has also been reunited with her father." So it began with a crisis. And for Jacob's sons, the strange, critical, and unpredictable event that sparked their reconciliation was the famine. Number two, nerves. Any move towards reconciliation is always going to feel risky. Is it worth disturbing things? See Joseph's first move when he met his brothers. Turn back to chapter 42 and verse 7. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he asked. And perhaps we're thinking, well, why was he so tough in his approach? And the answer must be, surely, because he couldn't trust them. He couldn't trust that they had changed over those years. So the only way was to test them out. If they hadn't changed, perhaps they would be willing to sacrifice Simeon's freedom for their own safety, or more significantly, Benjamin's. Joseph and Benjamin's mother was Rachel. All the other brothers had a different mother. And Jacob's favorite wife had been Rachel. Joseph was only too aware that they had once sacrificed him, and now he would wait to see if they were prepared to sacrifice Benjamin. Nerves ensure that when it comes to family reconciliation, we are cautious and realistic. Number three, guilt. Again from chapter 42, and particularly verses 20 and 21, you'll see that Joseph says, "You must bring your youngest brother to me, so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." This they proceeded to do. And they said to one another, "Surely we are being punished because of our brother. We saw at the time, just before he was sold into slavery, we saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us." This was a bit like a bugging device. The brothers were speaking in their own language, not realizing that Joseph, of course, could understand it perfectly. And it demonstrated to him as they spoke that they were genuinely troubled by their treatment of him in the past. They were actually feeling God's punishment. And later Judah was to say on behalf of them all, "God has uncovered your servant's guilt." Now on a personal level again, I'm very sorry to report that when I was about 12 years old, one of my sisters threw a hardback book at me from very close range. The spine was ripped off as a result. I was extremely lucky not to suffer serious physical injury, but of course I've had to manage severe psychological damage ever since. Anyway, years later I reminded her of the incident. Sadly, there was not even a suggestion of remorse. She could only mutter something about me probably deserving it. But with Joseph's brothers, there were clear signs that they were admitting their guilt for their terrible actions. And guilt is the third requirement for reconciliation. Number four, emotions. There was no hope if Joseph remained entirely cool and detached. But he wasn't. Over all this, he was clearly deeply emotional, even though he didn't fall apart until right at the end. Hearing his brothers talking about the episode when they sold him into slavery, just look at chapter 42 and verse 24. It says, "He turned away from them and began to weep, but then turned back and spoke to them again." And when Benjamin arrived, over the page in chapter 43 and verse 30, "Is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Just imagine how that did feel at the time. Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went into his private room and wept there. The word translated "deeply moved" is used in 1 Kings of a mother's feeling for her child at the prospect of its death. Reconciliation is motivated not just by duty, but by a deep feeling of longing. Number five is trust. Parents normally know, we only learn this as we grow a bit older, But parents normally know when their children are not telling the whole truth. There is little doubt that Jacob did not believe the tale his sons told him when Joseph disappeared. And so that would explain his extreme reluctance to let Benjamin out of his sight and entrust Benjamin's safety to his other sons, who he felt sure were responsible for the loss of Joseph. No wonder he comes across as a great warrior who was always fearing the worst. But moving through these chapters, it is clear that the brothers had grown up, and Judah in particular showed that his experiences had matured him into a fine, unselfish and godly man. He was able to persuade his father that he would look after Benjamin, and then persuade his brother Joseph that he would lead his brothers into a two-way reconciliation. The timing proved crucial. Progress is rarely made without process. Desire for reconciliation is not enough. And what happened in chapter 45 could not have happened in chapter 42. Anyway, let's move on to number 6, the last of these, generosity. When we get into the New Testament, we read some very famous words from the Apostle Paul about love. And one of the things he said was that love meant keeping no record of wrongs. There is an instinct in us human beings that is always tempted to mention things in the past that are best not mentioned. In chapter 45, Joseph, knowing how far Judah had gone in his speech, he comes up with no recriminations. The past is past. And sometimes it is dangerous to dig it up again, especially when it's not necessary, to insist on a public confession. Knowing, as he had done over the previous two or three chapters, discovering their current attitude, he leaves the past alone. It's the future that counts. Let's move on. And so he says in chapter 45 and verse 9, "Now hurry back to my father and say to him, this is what your son Joseph says," and so on. Hurry back and say, "Come down to me." And we see here in Joseph a generosity of spirit, which is then followed up practically, saying, "I will provide for you." And the carts were dispatched to fetch Jacob and his belongings. And when Jacob sees them, he is convinced. It's really quite moving as you get to verse 27, right at the end of chapter 45. "But when they had told him everything Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts," the sort of removal vans, if you like, "that Joseph had sent to carry him back, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And Israel said, 'I'm convinced. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.'" The old man knew that he wasn't dreaming. And after a long 22 years, the family breakdown was over, and they were together at last. And so we come to heading 3, which is the shortest of the three, but extremely important. Because number 3 is, that's God, the road to faith in adversity. No reading of Scripture is adequate without the heading, that's God. Now, throughout the chapters today, occasionally, if you look closely, you'll see that God pokes through. It's as though sometimes he breaks the surface, sometimes on the lips of Joseph or of Jacob or of the brothers, even Joseph's Egyptian staff. And the Bible is showing through this story that in the dark times, when Joseph's reputation and security were at their very lowest points, God was with him, as he will be with us. And we hang on to that. Maybe we persuade ourselves sometimes that God has promised us outcomes that he hasn't. However, we are to hang on to his promise that will never fail, that his purposes are for good. When, as a boy, I climbed Helvellyn in the English Lake District, we spent most of the climb totally enclosed within the clouds, unable to see beyond the next few steps. And I still remember very vividly now that when we came quite close to the summit, the clouds suddenly opened. The sun shone through, and we were presented with a view revealing the mountains, the valleys, and the whole surrounding area. At first, it almost felt and looked surreal. It was like a mirage, magical, a dream. Yet it dawned on us that what we could now see and enjoy was all genuinely real and true. And Genesis chapter 45, 4 to 8, is that experience. It's not only the climax of the story, but the climax of our understanding. And in case you think it's bound to be beyond our little minds, it is expressed very simply. Let me take these two couples. First of all, Joseph said, "You sold me." And then almost immediately afterwards, Joseph said, "But God sent me." How did I find my uncomfortable way to Egypt? You sold me. But he answers the same question again by saying, "But God sent me." If you look at verses 4 and 5, then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." And when they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. But now do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you." The first of those is common sense, human beings being human beings. The second is God being God. When Peter preached about Jesus on the day of Pentecost, his audience were cut to the heart because he had told them, "You crucified him." But in the very same speech, he also said, "This man, Jesus, was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge." The fact that both those statements are true, not one of them, or neither, is not a distressing problem to be solved. It is a belief to be gladly accepted. "You sold me," said Joseph. That meant that they had painfully to work through the agonies of brutally broken relationships. But also, "God sent me" meant God has his way. The second of these couples, if you like, is the purpose of Joseph. As we've already read in chapter 5, the purpose of Joseph coming to Egypt was to save lives. And that was very obvious. As it says in verse 6, "For 2 years now there's been famine in the land. For the next 5 years there will not be plowing and reaping." Joseph was there to bring aid to people in famine. But there is again a second part, and that comes out in verse 7. "God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." To save lives, but also to save or to preserve a remnant on earth. Another word for remnant is survivors. God had promised Abraham that whatever might appear to be going wrong, he would preserve and ensure that his family survived. The Joseph story was another chapter in what God was doing. So we've thought tonight about the road to Egypt, that's life. The road to reconciliation, that's families. And the road to faith and adversity, that's God. And it's worth just remembering, this is not only the big picture. This is God's big picture. He is the real subject of the whole episode. And being a Christian disciple is not only about how we behave and precisely what we believe, but it's about the perspective that we have. Learning to have the perspective that God wants us to hold, whatever is happening in our lives and in the world. It's not a perspective that just assures us that we personally will be okay, whatever seems to go wrong. It's a perspective that fixes our eyes always on Jesus Christ. Even though sometimes it seems that our world is sliding away from Him, God's eternal will and purpose is still on course.